Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Dear gas prices, go take a hike. Toyota is the number one retail brand for electrified vehicles for 22 years. The Toyota hybrid lineup brings efficiency with power and savings with style. Not to mention top tech to help keep you connected. Plush premium interiors and the most advanced Toyota safety features. So, now you know who you're talking to. Toyota, the number one retail brand for electrified vehicles for 22 years. With a hybrid or electric vehicle built for every driver. Seriously, dear gas prices, do you really think you can stand in our way? Think again. Toyota hybrids. Find yours at Toyota.com. Toyota, let's go places.
Based on manufacturer estimates, CY 2000 through 2021 sales.
Welcome back into another edition of The Kickabout here on The Blue Room. I'm your host, Rob Vera. We are missing Mark Mosey this week, but that's okay. We have got the very capable, and I mean that sincerely, Les, the very, very capable Les Roberts. I mean, you're more than capable, buddy, but saying very capable almost sounds like more of a compliment than just saying, you know, the capable. That means almost like your replacement level. And I don't want you to ever feel that way, buddy.
Just being described as capable is enough for me. I don't think I've ever had that before. So,
well, as God, man. You know, it's funny because whenever Mark's away, I always think this is an opportunity to talk about actual non-Everton things. You know, because for some reason, Mark, who is one of the smartest, coolest guys I know, seems allergic to movie talk or music talk. And normally if I've got just you and me on, it's like I can get away with it a little bit more. And look, I will still shoehorn that shit in as much as I can. But I was saying before we hit record though, Les, that like as much as I would love to get into non-Everton things today, it's just sometimes I don't know if it's the story writes itself or the events of the day sort of dictate things, but I don't even know where to begin because since the last time we recorded, tell me if I'm missing anything, okay? We had the announcement and all the hype around the walkout. Then we had Marcel Brands leaving the club. Then we had the game. We had the walkout sort of kind of failing a little bit, at least in terms of the gesture. We'll talk about that as we get into it, even though I still am for the movement, of course. But and then the game itself, Les, and I swear to God, maybe it's because Everton wins so infrequently, but it feels like this win has so many talking points that I just don't know where to begin. So Look, I feel like the Marcel Brands thing, you and I have probably touched on that. Mark and I touched on it on the last couple of spaces that we did. I think we've kind of beaten that subject to death. But before we get into the Arsenal game on Monday, from this past Monday, do you have any other kind of final thoughts that have been processing, stewing, anything else about Marcel Brands and the kind of ascension of Rafa Benitez to a more powerful place at the club?
Not a lot really, other than we still don't know anything about what Marcel Brands did or his vision for the club. And if we think about it logically, the writing was on the wall as soon as Benitez took the job.
Right.
Because Benitez, wherever he goes, he gets what he wants or he walks. And there's no way Mashiri was going to do anything but back what he wanted, having appointed him. He's not gonna back down and give him the boot or not give him what he wants after, what, 3 months in charge, whatever it is, 4 months.
Yeah.
So I think if we look at it sort of realistically, this was probably coming a long time ago.
Wasn't the writing on the wall when they hired Carlo Ancelotti, though? I mean, and this is why the whole sequence of things was strange, because it appeared very clear at the time that the club hired Carlo Ancelotti that was certainly not a, quote, Brand's choice. And then the subsequent signings of James Rodriguez, Alan, and Decore, you know, maybe Ben Godfrey was a Brand signing. The fact that we are still playing this game of trying to give our best guess as to who signed who is really the biggest indictment of the entire structure, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we shouldn't be in any doubt as to what his job was. It should have been in charge of recruitment, in charge of the academy, and nothing really improved while he was there. The academy probably went backwards.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was on its way down anyway, but it's, you know, the players were bringing through, not making the first team, selling phenomenal amounts. And if you compare that with Liverpool, they're selling players no one's ever heard of for 15, 20 million because they've got that academy now that's got that reputation. Whereas Everton did have an academy with that reputation, but that's slowly been eroded, I think. And it's not what it was because it's not producing the players that it should be.
Well, Liverpool can also sell their players for inflated prices because they're successful, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's got to be – I think that there is some sort of semi-symbiotic relationship between a club's ability to value prospects at a high level, even if they've never played for the first team or they barely played for the first team. I think about, I don't know, half a dozen Southampton buys from Liverpool over the years, but it seems like it's got to be related just simply to the name value of a club that is winning things. Like if Everton were winning things, they might, it's sort of chicken or egg. They'd probably be winning more if the academy was better. And really it goes back to the kind of Pyrrhic victories of winning the PL2 titles and stuff like that, which, like, at a certain point, it just doesn't matter because the entire point of the academy system is the development of players who will either eventually make it to the first team or perform so well that we can sell them on as assets. Is that a pretty fair characterization?
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of like the tax on England players as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if the player's English, they automatically lost 10, 15 million on the value. Just on that Premier League too, just quickly. So this is how bad our luck has been with Derby. So me, my dad and the kids went to the final game of the season when Everton under-23s won the Premier League 2. It was against Liverpool. It was like, come on, it's the big deck. We've got to beat Liverpool.
Sure.
This level didn't. the day we lifted the title, we got beat by them at home. Unbelievable.
Yeah, that seems very Everton on some level, doesn't it?
I don't think we give it up now.
Yeah, I can only talk about the academy so much before I start to get sad. So I don't want to do that. Let's just jump into the game because I don't know. Like I said, I think that sometimes the wins feel more significant because, frankly, of where we're at right now and how infrequent success has been for us, especially this season or especially the last couple months. I mean, more than anything, I want to isolate the or kind of kind of divide these into discussions about the immediate importance of the game and the result, which we just needed when you haven't won anything for 2 months and you're flirting with relegation, which, hey, we're up to 12th, but one game, and that's a huge relief, but, you know, we've seen how fast it can all turn. So that part's important. In the bigger picture of things, obviously, because of kind of where things are with the club and everything else, this felt big because I found after rewatching certain parts of it and obviously having watched the game, I don't know how you say it, watched it live, but not in person, whatever that means, you know, watch it on television. It was funny to me how many Everton storylines were encapsulated, like bigger picture storylines, almost like microcosms were upon microcosms inside of one single game. Everything from your best center half who has injury issues coming back after a long layoff and 30 minutes in being injured again. You know, I mean, the Yerry Mina thing makes me sad, but at the same time, I remembered that, God, how many of Everton's best players have had injury issues and how much is that part of the huge problem that we have at the club? Then you had VAR rearing its ugly head. The first goal, okay. I still probably – there's a part of me that thinks that if you were introducing this sport to a new consumer of the sport – that you'd have to explain to them how having your elbow swinging slightly forward across an invisible line is a competitive advantage that you've gained that should negate a goal, which is a very rare thing, in, you know, relatively speaking, that happens in a game. But fine. That second one, I don't care what anyone says. I understand what they're talking about and that they've added this second line in there, what have you, but – I mean, we're talking about millimeters of or maybe an inch of a foot. And I still think, my idea, Les, and I'd love your thoughts on this too, probably, is that why don't they just say that as long as any part of the attacking player's foot is in line with any part of the defending player's foot, that, you know, you've been played onside at that point. I don't know. No one has a perfect solution, but whatever. I don't want to get too deep into that. The goal, the game-winning goal, and I wanted to point this out. I don't know if you've gone back and watched it a million times like I have, Les. You know, it gets me real excited, gets me hot watching that goal. one of the things that also felt like kind of a boy, what does this say about Everton, is you had – everyone involved in that goal, it was really interesting. You had Mason Holgate, who at one point was the great hope of the future of Everton's back four or back line, getting this. And I think people kind of missed this, but he had a pretty crucial kind of athletic, acrobatic interception. That ball was kicked out and deflected straight to Alan, who, you know, his, as inconsistent as he can be, put a perfect, you know, outlet pass out to Andre Gomez. Now, at any point of this sequence, you're waiting for something to fail. I'm waiting for Alan's pass to get intercepted because, God, we've seen this all season, how many times they can't put three passes together. But then Andre Gomez, speaking of players that we put a lot of hope in that have had horrible injury histories at Everton, just being generally underwhelming, looks like, I think as much as the goal, and don't get me wrong, the goal, of course, the finish is the best part. But that finish doesn't happen without an absolute set of world-class moves from Andre Gomez.
Yeah, he always threw that midfield, doesn't he?
He said, but it was like slow motion. It was... I think Matt Flusk described it well. It was like he swerved this way, swerved that way. It was like watching one of those old slow motion highlight films of they used to do this over here on Saturday mornings, NFL Films Presents. NFL Films has always done these like really movie production level recordings of American football games over here. And the best part of it was they put this like amazing dramatic classical music to this slow motion shot of a running back, like making a juke and a move here and then getting past the guy and running like the Baywatch run, you know, for a touchdown in slow motion. It's incredible. But Andre Gomes is so slow. Like, I just sort of expected that he's going to get the ball taken off of him at any time. But he Jedi mind tricked the fuck out of those guys and just got it upfield, got it to Damari Gray, who did the rest. And I'll tell you, Les, everything that I love and hate, including players involved in that sequence – and really just it felt so Everton to have all of the ideas that Everton have had, or several of the ideas Everton have had over the last few years, encapsulated into one sequence. Mm-hmm. Failed idea, Mason Holgate. I don't know how we feel about Alan, but sometimes some people hate him and some people love him. And I don't know how I feel about
him. Yeah, I think I've got a Ben and a difference, really. He can, it's the Gattuso thing. Sometimes maybe good, sometimes maybe shit. You just don't know. And that can be in the space of 5 minutes as well.
Yeah, very true. Andre Gomes, the idea of Andre Gomes, what we saw, that was the idea. That was what we thought we were signing. And he'll do that. And then we'll think, like we talked about at the end of the game, well, now he's got to start. Let's see how he does. And then inevitably the magic somehow disappears. So I'm fully expecting him to just be back to being a slug again against Palace. But it was the best outcome of the idea of Andre Gomes to one of the very few ideas that has absolutely positively come off in flying fashion, which is the absolute robbery of Damari Gray from Leverkusen, right? Yeah. I feel like I could write a 10,000 word essay on that goal alone and how it ties to the recent business dealings of Everton in the last few years and the hopes and dreams and failures and successes all at once. But everything that I was so mad about, as dejected as I was when those two goals were disallowed, seeing the way that they fought back, seeing how Richarlison reacted, and then a stoppage time goal where I knew my friends were in the Gladys Street and other parts of the park just going ape shit. I mean, that's what it's all about, isn't it, Les?
Yeah, that's what we're in it for. And as you said, it doesn't really happen that often. So you've really got to milk it and enjoy it when it does. Hence, everyone going back and watching it about 3,000 times since Monday. But just to pick up on a couple of the points there, the VAR thing, the offside rule, that has just annoyed me for so long, because there's physically nothing a striker can do to know that part of his body's going to be offside. So I just think with that rule, if you've got to start drawing lines on the pitch, it's not offside. You give the benefit of the doubt to the attacker, which is how it should be anyway. And when players are level, you know, they're onside. So as a striker, when you're learning how to play the game, you look across that line. And if you look at that defender in your level, it doesn't matter if your arm swings out like that ahead of him. As the linesman sees it, he can see that two bodies are level, two players are level. That's onside. As a striker, that's all you can do. Similarly, as a defender, that's all you can do. You can look at the striker, take a step back to play him offside. So I think the VAR thing with the lines on the pitch, it takes out all of the skill. You know, the players just don't have that ability to like micromanage, but just have that microscopic view of everywhere their body is in relation to another player on the off chance that he might be caught offside. Mike Riley even said decisions like that. He literally said toenail decisions will not be given this season. And that's exactly what Richarlison's was.
The second one especially, again, the first one, okay, even though I still in spirit kind of disagree with the generality of the rule. That second one was what we were supposed to be getting rid of this season, isn't it?
Exactly. And it exacerbates the problem we've been having with VAR all season, in the fact that those two goals were deemed worthy of a VAR check, yet Rondon getting the shirt torn off at Brentford wasn't. So, I mean, I don't know what the logic is behind that. Then you've got the Spurs penalty as well, whereby that went to a VAR check, and that was seen as an obvious decision, obvious mistake by the referee, which it clearly wasn't. I just don't know where they're going with this or what they're trying to do, other than it just looks like cheating them. It just looks like if they don't like the look of a decision, they can just go, tell you what, just call it off, and you can chalk it off. Or if they do like the look of a decision, you just don't look at it. It's shite, basically. They still aren't using it correctly. They still haven't got it right. I don't really think they ever will, especially not with Mike Riley at the head of the referees. He was a terrible referee anyway, Mike Riley. So the fact
I remember.
Yeah, the fact that he heads up the whole organisation now says it all. Anyway, back to the Toffees, though. Before Damari Gray's goal, Richarlison's header for that equaliser was absolutely stunning.
The skill on that, Les, I want you to do this because I see it and I'm watching it and I'm blown away by it on some level. But for those of us listening, for those listening to this who are not, who are like me, who played football as a 5-year-old for about 10 minutes and then that was about it and then became a fan later, someone who's been in the game, has coached the game, I mean, I think that because there's something about just this kind of floating, looping header finding its way in, that's not, I think sometimes we assign difficulty to the missiles, you know what I mean? To the shots that are just like, you know, missiles. Whereas I don't think people understand just how, what level of skill was required to pull off this shot. Tell me how difficult that header was from Richarlison, because I thought it was incredibly impressive.
Yeah, because when you saw the basics in football, you're always taught as a striker to get over the ball and head it down, and that's all you're ever taught, really. You never taught those situations where the ball spins up in the air and you've got to improvise. It was essentially a headed version of an overhead kick. It's not something you ever really taught. It's something you've just got to improvise as the play dictates. But that ball, I mean, that was a great save as well. It was a great shot from Damari Gray. It was a great save from Ramsdale, who just got a fingertip on it, which then spun the ball onto the bar, which then spun up in the air. So you can't get any power on it. So really, the way he jumped and arched his back and just, I don't know, he just sort of got some sort of loop on
the header. Is it a volley? Is it almost like a head volley?
Yeah, it was.
I don't even know how to describe it.
The technique was outrageous, and it doesn't look that impressive on, like, just seeing it, he's just looped the header in. But when you think of all the factors that have gone to get the ball into that position, and he's taken the decision to just head it the way he did, instead of maybe taking it down or, you know, trying to take a touch and getting a shot off, he's just gone straight for the header and it's looped in. It was brilliant. It reminded me of, do you remember the Jelovic header at Old Trafford?
Oh,
it was a bit like that, just cushioned and looped in. But I think it was better than that one, just because of the spin on the ball, the speed that came back off the bar. But yeah, I mean, he showed in that game exactly why everyone loves him and why, you know, if he does have a game where he subs, you can't write him off, because he's probably more frustrated with himself that he can't have the impact on the game. I think that's his big issue. When he has ineffective games and he looks like he's sulking, it's because he can't have the impact that he wants to have on that game. Maybe it's with his teammates as well that they're not, because you can understand that. You know, he's bordering on elite level player now. He's going to be an elite level player. He's going to get there. So when you're seeing your teammate not quite up to that standard, that's going to, you know, it's going to make you a bit mardy with them, isn't it?
Yeah. I think sometimes the discussion around Richarlison is, like, there's two different discussions that go on about him, at least in terms of two audiences. There's the discussion that happens amongst Evertonians about Richarlison, and then there is the discussion that happens about Richarlison outside of our bubble that is largely, I think, full of largely uninformed speculation and opinions. And I mean, and we're guilty of doing some of this too. I've always been very critical of the taking the look on a guy's face and inferring a bunch of deep meaning behind it, or that because a player looks frustrated that they're not trying. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm sure that there have been times where he's dipped a little bit in terms of maybe being engaged, though given the service he's had in his time at Everton overall. I don't think he's A, the only one who's guilty of that, and B, I think it's somewhat understandable. But this concept of him being an elite player is this, I think, sometimes becomes an overly simplistic discussion of, well, when Richarlison eventually gets rid of all of these rough edges, like, guys, I don't think that that's ever going to be who he is. No. I think Richarlison is going to be one of those guys who, yes, can improve and will improve in some ways, especially once he goes to a better side that has more weapons around him. He will flourish. He'll be great. But Richarlison as a player is kind of baked in at this point. And you know what? I don't really mind the version of Richarlison we have now. Yes, I want more goals, but I also would sort of say that you'll get more goals from Richarlison when other players around him are, like, it's so easy for the defense to focus on him when Everton has nothing else to really threaten a lot of the time. I think Damari Gray helps that. I think that Monday night should have been a hat trick game that was talked about as one of the best games of any by any player all season in the Premier League. Like, that's how. And by the way, I would throw out there now that when Richarlison eventually goes, this is one of his signature games at Everton that we're all going to talk about. We're all going to remember, because in some ways it was even more impressive because of his mental response to having two goals somewhat criminally, at least that's how he felt, taken away from him in a crucial game and an important moment in the season for a struggling side flirting with. I mean, add all the context you want, it makes it even more impressive. But I think that Richarlison is a player whose kind of innate rage, anger, and I don't even mean that in a derogatory way. I just think some players have to have that chip on their shoulder and that edge. They have to feel like it's them against the world out there. They have to get into physical confrontations. They probably talk a lot of trash out there. Like, that's Richarlison. And you know what? Everyone who's been trying to get him to, you know, it's, and I say this in the most loving way possible, there's this thing that a lot of like old school white fans of the sport do with players of color who have attitude and have, you know, have personality and have a little bit of angst to their game. And they're trying to tell them, you need to be more like, I think everyone wants a player like that to be more like Phil Jagielka or something. I don't know what they want. But my point is that I think Richarlison, if you take away too much of that, and he's got to find a balance, and don't get me wrong, he is open to criticism, and he certainly can improve his temperament in some ways. But you can't take too much of the edge away from Richarlison, because then I think you fundamentally change what makes him special. The instinctual stuff, the moments of transcendence that he can provide in those big moments, the way he can drag a team with him like he did the other night.
Well, this is where, from his own career point of view, he needs to consider his next move really carefully.
Right.
Because he needs to be, if not the focal point of the team, the next best thing. So if you look historically, I'm going to use the example of Maradona.
Okay.
Massive in Argentina, went to Barcelona, didn't really quite work out for him there, went to Napoli, played the best football of his life, and dragged a pretty average team that hadn't won a trophy for decades, I think, to the title in Italy. And you're talking about some top-notch teams in Italy at the time, like AC Milan, in the late 80s. So he was the, like Richarlison, who was a player who's got to have, he's got to be made angry when he's playing to get the best out of him. He's got to have his back against the wall. He's got to feel like it's him and his team against everyone else. I think Maradona had, I'm not comparing him directly to Maradona.
No, but that's okay. We're an analogy here that more people understand. I like it.
But I think in the temperament way of things, it's very similar to that. So if he does get a big move next, he's really got to consider where he goes. Because if he goes into a team where he's just another cog, you can use Wayne Rooney as a similar example as well. He won everything and he was still a great player. But I think it's pretty accepted amongst Evertonians anyway that he probably never became the player that he could have been, because that fire was taken out of him a bit when he went to Man United. He became just a part of something much bigger than him. So I think for Richarlison, it's a good point that he does sort of need that feeling in games. And if you do move to a team that's more successful, you're less likely to get that feeling because you're probably going to be rolling teams over. So it's a tricky one for him personally, what he does next. Hopefully he'll stay with us forever. But, you know, not going to kid ourselves that that'll happen. No. But it's just, he's a very complex character, isn't he?
Well, what's funny, I think you make a really interesting point I hadn't thought about, because I sometimes think that one of the ways that you get a clue about where a player's going to end up is you look at the heavy speculation from a move that never ended up happening the summer before, because then at least you have some idea that, okay, some conversations have happened. Now, I don't know how much this applies in this case, because if you'd asked me, about next season, I'd say, well, there's a decent chance he ends up at PSG, right? Yeah. Because of the speculation. But now that it's sort of up in the air about, who's staying and who's going, you've got the health and fitness of Neymar that plays into that equation a little bit. I wonder if the relationship with Neymar is part of what fueled some of that desire to potentially go there. But I think you're right. Like, I think that there is a move out there for him to a better side than us that is not so star laden that he gets lost in the mix, because his ego is such, and by the way, this is true of a lot of the great, great scorers in the history of this sport, but his ego is such that he judges his success on the pitch by his ability to contribute in the scoring column. And even though he tracks back like no other forward in the league, even though he is just about as max effort in general in terms of the physical side of the game, and I still think he can improve as a passer, even though we've started to see some really nice work there, but he still turns the ball over a bit. I mean, he's not a finished product. I don't know that anyone ever fully is a finished product on some level, but I think you're right. Like, I think he goes somewhere where he is still one of the, like you said, top two focal points. Now, I will say this, as much as I have thought for the, like, I don't know about you, Les, I've thought for the last 2 seasons maybe that Richarlison was going to be gone, and yet he's here. And so I want to sort of put the brakes on the whole he's definitely gone next summer thing, because A, I think there's just so much that can happen between now and then, and B, I think that now finally the Calvert-Lewin portion of this equation is coming into play, meaning that I absolutely can see the club potentially parting with one of these two, but both in one summer. I mean, it could happen, but man, you would have to have a lot of faith, which I don't, in this hierarchy, in that money correctly, because it would be a significant amount of money.
Yeah.
I do think Luka Dean's gone. I do think that, I don't know about Yuri. I don't know about Yuri Mina. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know about Yuri Mina, because he's not, it's weird, because in some ways these injuries are actually maybe keeping him here for the last year of his contract more than it is, you know, expediting a sale. So I don't know about that, but I think Everton have some assets that they are going to part with as part of this idea of restructuring the whole thing. But I'm just trying to imagine them selling both Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison in the same summer. And that just feels dangerous to me. I don't know.
That would be slightly suicidal, I think.
Yeah.
Just because you're leaving yourself with no striker then, other than Rondon, which we have done in the past, to be fair, when we sold, what was the name of that we sold to Leicester? Scored that worldie against Chelsea on the last game of the season.
That we sold to Leicester?
No, I keep thinking Marcus Bent. It wasn't Marcus Bent. Anyway.
Oh, gosh, yeah. You're asking the wrong.
Yeah, no.
My memory sucks. What's funny is that I will remember Monday forever, because there's some games, like I always joke on this show, was that Mike D'Ascia, one of my very closest friends in the Blue Room universe, has this steel trap memory for every game, and I don't. But the ones I remember are usually significant. Let me know if you find it, Les. But
yeah, well, Jermaine Beckford, that was the one.
Oh, like God, him. Yeah.
We sold him to, I think we sold him to Leicester, and then
forget about £4 million.
And we just didn't have a striker for about two seasons. So we stuck with Fellaini and Cahill. So, you know, there is precedent there for Everton doing something stupid like that and getting rid of any recognised striker. But I think that will be a bit of a step too far for the club. Yeah. Just too much of a risk. But yeah, as you say, I think one probably will go, unfortunately. Which would be a shame because they work really well together. And for the last two seasons, we've not really seen the best of them both together, have we?
Right.
Yerry Mina, I think Benitez saying he's injury prone has probably knocked about 10 million off his value anyway. So that was a stupid thing to say. But yeah, I can see him.
But it's obvious for everyone to see too. I mean,
it is, yeah. But I think when the manager comes out and says it, it just adds that little sort of thing that the buying club can go, well, we're taking an injury prone player off your hands, which is a shame because that defense is infinitely better.
It's the ultimate. It's so Everton that you know, they had the right idea. They go out and bought this player who, yes, you can say was this World Cup famous, had the bounce or whatever. But they were buying a young, big, physically imposing guy with all these leadership qualities. He had a little bit of – he obviously had, you know, some stop and start because of injuries to start. Then he – at one point got into a nice little run of form where he was healthy for a good solid 6-7 months. And then it started all over again this season. And I don't want to get into a whole Yerry Mina thing. I think we all know he's a really good player, but I said this on Twitter yesterday and believe me, I never thought I'd say this. He is not.
I was shocked when I read it, to be honest.
Well, but that's the thing is I'm not. I think people need to understand. You can love a player, but you can acknowledge reality. Okay.
Oh, God, yeah.
Just like some of the people who I spar with, they can love a player all they want, but he shouldn't be the starting right back at the club anymore in 2021. But my point is that. By the way, Coleman was great. Was great on Monday night. He had a crucial block that. Our winner that was huge. Anyway, that's for you, Laura. it's a joke about our friend Laura Gates. She knows what I'm talking about. But Yerry Mina knew the deal. And that's the thing about when you talk about a player in injuries, you know, you're not really talking about the failure of a player in terms of it's not an effort thing. It's not even a talent thing or a skill thing. It's not about a lack of desire. I think that every time he goes out there, you can tell that guy gives a shit. Yeah. That guy is a nightmare for whatever attacking player he's up against. I love all those things, but going into this season, I put my hand up and said, I agreed with Matt Jones. We talked about this. He has to probably play between 20. I said low end 28. Matt was saying about 30 league games in order to prove that he could stay fit. He hasn't done it. I think he has been completely mishandled by the meat grinder aspect of this entire sport, by the way, which says that, hey, we're going to have you play nonstop all summer for Colombia. Then after Copa America is over, you're going to start the season, get a delayed start to the season, and then have to go back again for a triple header, three games, three starts, 90 plus minutes. I think they went to extra time in one of those games.
Yeah.
I mean, Colombia killed him, Les, and he comes back, and it's like a lot of soft tissue injuries. You strain a hamstring or a quad, you recover that, and then – I mean, you see this in a lot of sports. The next thing that happens is a calf injury or a quad or, like anything in that same leg, something usually happens because you're overcompensating. You're doing, you've been working one set of muscles out to try and get it better. It sucks because he's had bad luck and it is what it is. But Everton are going to have to figure out the back line. And I think going back to the game, and I'd love your thoughts on this. You know, I thought Michael Keane was pretty good. Mm-hmm. I think he's also been very bad at points this season. I have not liked the way he looks like he's given up on a few goals this season.
Yeah.
But he was good. I think the scary thing, though, looking ahead to Palace and beyond, is that we're staring Mason Holgate, Michael Keane as your starting center halves in the face for a while, because I think that Ben Godfrey pretty much has to stay at left back, doesn't he? Well, I mean, you can't put Holgate out there, and I just am not. I hope Dean is back, but I'm not convinced that this gets resolved overnight.
This is the thing I think people have gone really overboard on with Luca Dean. Now, Benitez may not fancy him. They may have fallen out. But you can't really criticise Benitez because Everton won. And Ben Godfrey played really well. So it's tough to criticise Benitez for doing that, because as a manager, you've got to make those tough calls. And it doesn't matter who the player is. If they're out of form, which Luca Dean has been, regardless of whether the manager said, you've got to stay back more, you're not allowed to go up the pitch as much as you like to cross the ball. You're a left back. Your first priority is to defend. So if a manager asks you to defend, you just got to get on with it. And if you can't do it, or you're not good enough at doing that, well, then the manager's got to take a look at you and go, well, do you know what? You're not fit for the purpose I need you to be in the team for right now. Now, had he put Ben Godfrey in and we've been beaten, well, then you could look at it and go, well, right, it was a stupid thing to, you know, we lost all that attacking edge down that side. But the fact is we won and Ben Godfrey played well. So you can't really criticise the manager for that just because you like the player. And I like Luca Dean. I think he's a left back. He's just been, he has been out of form for a while now. He's been up and down, but he is a quality left back, and I'd sooner see him in the team than not. But by the same token, if the manager makes that decision, that's his job. He's there to make those tough calls. And some managers in the past would have left Luca Dean in purely because he's your captain. He's one of the star players. He's probably, you know, a pretty big fish at Finch Farm because he's come from Barcelona, PSG. He's a bit of a star player.
He's a French international.
It takes a lot for a manager to drop a player like that. But if that's what he sees fit, that's what this club has needed for a long time, for a manager who's single-minded enough to do that. The flip side of it, of course, is that you get fallings out then, and that's not good for the team. So if this is allowed to fester, it could have a negative impact on the team long run. It could end up with Luca Dean walking. It could end up with him going for, you know, less than we would ideally get from if he was playing well and in the team. It could knock valuation off him. So there's a lot of moving parts in this whole situation. But I think until Ben Godfrey absolutely stinks the gaff out at left back, he can't be criticised for playing there because he's offering defensive solidity that the team needs at the minute that Luca Dean wasn't. Plus, Luca Dean gives away a lot of stupid fouls in and around the box. That's a massive criticism of him. So when the team's on the back foot, as a manager, you will need a player you can rely on defensively, which at this moment, Ben Godfrey is. It might change for Palace. It might be water under the bridge, but I think there's been a bit of an overreaction because people are really quick and want to criticise Benitez.
Everyone wants to take a side because they just want to immediately go to a side when it's more nuanced than that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It everything's seen as black and white. You've got to pick a team and stick in that lane. When it's not really like that. I like Luca Dean. I don't particularly like Benitez, but he's the Everton manager, and I want him to do well because of that. Ideally, I want Luca Dean to do well as well. But you know, if it's a head to head in the two, and the team's performing better without a certain player, that's the way it's got to be. And you know, and a manager has got to make those tough decisions, and it's good that he's doing that.
Well, and I mean, there's sort of a damned if you do, damned if you don't sort of thing, right? I mean, I don't know how many times over the years we have all lamented that these players get away with murder, and when is a manager going to be strong in cases like this or send a message? And then when one does, it's, you know, again, I guess it always depends on how you feel about the manager, right? But look, I'm a big fan of the many things can be true all at once a way of approaching these sorts of things, because I think, Les, you and I are probably on about the same page. I like Luca Dean. I really like Luca Dean because since he came to Everton, he has been one of the most consistent performers and producers. And when I say producers, meaning not just the eyeball test, but he has put up lots of assists. He has put up, he has scored goals. He's done the things that he was advertised to be bringing to Everton and more. I mean, really, yeah. We thought we were just kind of getting like a nice above average left back that would be perfectly fine and was good value for the money. Turned out to be great value for the money. But what's also true is that he can say all he wants about Benitez's system, which I agree, Benitez does not seem to favor, at least from what I can tell. And Les, I'll defer to you on the kind of the managerial, formational, tactical part of this, but he does not seem to employ a system that employs the quote modern fullback approach of having guys bombing down the wings. You know, he wants guys that are a little more defensively responsible. And I think you can also acknowledge that it's not so much about Luka Dean being poor as much as it is that this system does not play to the – he was acquired with one idea, and in fact it was several ideas ago. Yeah. And the player he is and the skill set he has does not lend itself well to what Benitez is ultimately trying to accomplish. Luka Dean's never been like a rock-solid defender. He's always just been at his best, just kind of – he'd have a – good, decent game here or there, but his value was in attack. If you can't, but we haven't even been getting the attack part. And you can say that that's Benitez's fault. You can say that that's Luka Dean's fault for not performing and not, you know, I mean, I think you can argue very, in a very valid manner that his crosses, his set piece deliveries, they've been bad for a while. Yes. And this goes back to, you know, last season too. So, I think that both the player and the manager share some portion of the quote blame, if you want to call it that. But I do think that one, if Luka Dean blew up at the manager and they weren't all on the same page going into what was an incredibly important game, and this was what the manager decided to do, you're right. He's somewhat validated by the outcome, isn't he? I mean, we won the game. If we hadn't won the game, there'd be a much more uproar of this. Secondly, though, I would say that Luka Dean, I don't know if you saw his Instagram story this morning. Yeah. He basically said, you know, of course, it's the very classic, and I feel for Patty, because Patty wrote a really well-sourced, thoughtful piece, and the reason that I love, you know, what Patty and Greg do sometimes is that they actually seem to take the reporting side of being a reporter, which means that they actually have to go and make calls and not just wait for a club brief and then write a story and say that that's reporting. They go out and actually ask questions, and they do these things the right way, and I give them a lot of credit for that. But you have the classic Luka Dean saying, don't believe everything you read. But he basically kind of said that this is football. The manager made a decision. I wanted to play. This is how it goes. But he didn't sound like, I want to leave Everton. He was very – you know, he loves – I think Luka Dean genuinely, while playing at Everton sometimes has not always been super fun, which, let's be honest, that hadn't been for all of us either. I think in general, Luka Dean has been a model professional at the club. So my hope is that the outcome of this is that we had this. The message was sent by the manager. The player took it like a man, was out for the game. He's back for Palace this weekend. I don't know if that means he starts, but maybe back in the squad and then back to his starting. Like, I just think the worst thing that can happen is that this is I worry and I suspect, though I hope I'm wrong, I'm worried that this will be prolonged because, A, we have a really, really dense, thick schedule coming up. And, B, you made the point earlier, Les, that I think is really key. Let's say that you've decided to move on from Luka Dean. The worst thing you can do is just crater his value in the market by him not only having come off a bad run of games, but then just not playing him at all. No one's going to pay what you think he's worth at that point. And so I think Everton have got to find a way. And I think it's good for Luka Dean, too, who's going to want a good contract at whatever the next place is for him. He has incentive to get back into things and play well. Mm-hmm. I think Everton are incentivized to have Luka Dean come back and play well for what he can offer on the pitch and what he can do for his value. So I hope that this does get resolved.
I've just got one final theory on the Luka Dean situation, and it could be the fact that if you want to play attacking fullbacks, you've got to have two centre-backs who you completely trust and you know you can rely on. And at the minute, Everton don't have that. So if you think back to when it was Baines and Coleman at the best, it was Jagielka and Distan at the back, or Jagielka, John Stones. It was two centre-halves who the manager knew he could rely on. Croke turns from John Stones aside. he was a very reliable centre-half alongside Phil Jagielka. At the minute, the team hasn't got two centre-backs playing together who it knows are completely solid and can do the covering job if the full-back bombs on as well. So it could be down to that. You know, it's like if you look at Liverpool as well, Andy Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold, they bomb forward because they know they have got two centre-backs who can do the job for them.
Yeah.
So I don't think Andy Robertson is half the player he is without Van Dijk next to him. I just don't think he is.
And he's not half the player he thinks he is.
Well, he's not. He clearly isn't. But it's the same token, isn't it? If you've got Luca Dean who wants to bomb forward and you're thinking, well, Michael Keane or Mason Holgate are next to him, it's a bit like, can you really trust either of them? And it just takes me mind. I keep having these flashbacks of that Watford game, the final 15 minutes, and just the way the whole defence disintegrated and people were just chasing the ball. And there's that one shot, I think, of, was it the fourth goal? Can't remember, but it's the one where Josh King just gets the ball played into the middle of the park and he's on his own because Michael Keane has ran over to the left-back position to cover it. It's things like that. That's going to get in the manager's head. And you just think, and Carlo Ancelotti did it last season out of necessity because Luca Dean was injured. But he played four centre-backs across the back.
And that was the best defensively we were all season long.
Yeah, that was because we needed defensive solidity.
Yeah.
And that's the thing you've got to build on. So, you know, there's going to be a load of factors that have come to a head over a few factors. But, you know, we don't know what's going on, but hopefully it won't be something that's personal and festers on for a while.
Well, and I'm pretty on the record about the fact that I don't – And believe me, I loved the result on Monday, but it's hard to look anyone in the face, you know, anyone in the eye and have a straight face and say you really firmly believe that Benitez is a long-term answer here. So, you know, there's that caveat to things. But to your earlier point, I think, though, that if you're going to appoint a manager, and we've all been crying out for a manager with a firm hand, and sometimes that means that things like this are going to happen. I think that the days of us being cool with letting players quote get away with murder, we feel like those are over, but it always does seem like we correct, right? We go from taskmaster manager to warm and fuzzy manager to the opposite. We always swing back and forth because we think we've got to correct. And Benitez, look, I think everyone's sort of new coming in. He is oddly but you know, that's weird because there are some of the players, especially when we were successful earlier on this season, who said, you know, I like him because he doesn't spend time telling me what I'm good at. He tells me what I'm not good at and what I can improve upon. And generally speaking, you know, like guys like Richarlison seem to really respect him. You know, Damari Gray obviously seems to as well, and Townsend and guys he brought in. But the thing with Benitez, though, is that I can sit here and try to analyze all his particular managerial approaches, his formations, which I want to go on to talk about here in a second as we look towards Palace. You know, all those things. But this is a bottom line business. He didn't win a game for 2 months. We just won on Monday. I look, Palace, that's the most dangerous Palace side that we've faced in a while. I there's a lot of their players I'd love to have at Everton, by the way. But you know, at the same time, I sort of expect us to go down there and at least get a point. I think that right now Benitez, the more he tries to make, you know, he can make an example out of Luka Dean as a one-off. But I will say this, until his record markedly improves, he's not going to have a lot of latitude to keep doing this. So that's why I'm sort of hopeful that cooler heads will prevail in the Luca Dean situation and we're going to have a decent outcome to all this. Yeah. Les, this weekend, so we've got Palace, we're away at Palace. I mean, can we win two games in a row? I don't know, but I'm gonna ask you the most burning question that I think we all have. After Monday, does Rafa Benitez look at what happened Monday and say, "I'm going to start three players in central midfield"? Les Roberts, go.
See, that's the tricky thing, isn't it? I think he should. I'm not convinced he will, though.
I'm not either, and it makes me crazy. He's so stubborn.
Yeah, because he doesn't. I think when we did that Spaces the other night, we were sort of saying maybe he's learned his lesson over a few things. Because, you know, Iwobi's essentially been bombed out of the team. He looks like he's going to be a sub at most. Now, probably shouldn't even get that after his miss on Monday, but we'll not go on that. We'll not go on that tangent.
I mean, Iwobi sort of is what Iwobi is at this point. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm not convinced that he seems like the sort of manager who he's got a way that he wants to play and he will implement that way of playing. He'll impose that on the players until they get it right, as opposed to change things. So if you look at a manager like Ranieri, he'll mix things up. He'll make changes where he needs to. He'll do whatever he needs. He probably takes games at a time, basically. And this is something you need to do when you're not as good a side. So basically, Man City, Liverpool, Chelsea, they can just play their way in every game. Apart from maybe against each other, weirdly. But they can play their way in every game. Anyone below that, you've really got to sort of set your stall out to sort of negate them first and then play.
Right, because of the talent discrepancies or because of what you have at your disposal. Like City and, you know, like City can employ any style they want whenever they want because they have players, you know, specialty players who can do everything, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but when it comes to a game like Everton Palace, who, well, there's 2 points between us now. Somehow we're 2 points ahead of them.
Which seems amazing.
It was
crazy
how much that win has elevated us because we were basically relegation fodder until Monday night. We still are, effectively, but... It's just mad to look at the table now. We're above Southampton, Leeds, Palace, Brentford, who had a decent start. We're a point behind Leicester, point behind Villa, who've just had a resurgence.
Yeah.
It's mad. The table is so tight there. But yeah, when you're playing a team like Palace, I think we need to play to our strengths. And at the minute, that is playing three in midfield. Mm-hmm. But I'm not convinced that you will. So if we're going to play Andre Gomes, you've got to play a three.
Well, and, okay, so that's my question. Because oftentimes the answer or the response to what I refer to as formational rigidity of a manager who's like, look, this is my formation and I will die playing this no matter what. But oftentimes they're forced into a rethink because of the personnel. Sometimes you just... I forget who said it, but you know, central midfield is one of the places where, ironically, we don't have injury issues right now. Everyone, even De Bommen is available. I mean, it's weird, but it just feels like I wonder if he can continue to live off of the reputation as a very logical and pragmatic manager, if he can look at the last 2 months and honestly say that this two-man midfield approach has worked. Now, I will grant you that Decore being out during that time is a mitigating factor in all this. But they just something seemed to really click on Monday. And again, it's a smaller sample size, but I would really like to see Allen in front of the back four. Mm-hmm. And I get, you know, again, who knows? With Gomez, we could get a world-class, you know, a world-class bordering performance, or we could get, you know, insert your own jokes about, I think, Malbec, I've heard a few times.
Malbec legs.
I forget who it was. One of my Twitter buddies said something about Monday night was scientific proof that long-haired Andre Gomez is Andre Gomez. He's probably right. So that's my question to you, Les, is does what Andre Gomez did and what he did on Monday was not anything you can ignore. It wasn't just that goal. He was good from the moment he came on. Really he awesome. looked like a breath of fresh air out there. And again, ironically, much like Yerry Mina, I think he may have even been on a longer prolonged absence. So part of me thinks that, A, you look at Andre Gomez doing that and you think you got a three-man midfield, start Gomez. The other part of me is thinking, though, that because he's just coming back, that he's got to probably be a bench option because of fitness concerns, which, ironically, if Luka Dean had been available, do you then put Yeri Mina back into the firing line starting as soon as, even though he's been off for, you know, seven games and clearly what, I mean, just, I just think that was a mistake, but it happens. With Andre Gomez, you wouldn't have started him for the same reasons. Mm-hmm. Does that still, I imagine that probably still comes into play Saturday. So I'm kind of like you. I think he probably starts with two men, you know, Allen and Decore. He might even go unchanged, frankly, obviously with Holgate replacing Mina, and then bring on Gomez again late. But it feels like you're just setting yourself up for playing from behind again, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there is Delph option, I think. Is he fit? Is he ever fit? If Delph's
that almost sounds like a philosophical question you're asking. Yeah. What is Delph? Where is Delph? How is Delph? I don't know, Les. That's an incredible question. I think Delph was Delph available on Monday? Do we remember? Was he in the squad? I don't think he was for some reason.
But if he is available,
that's a
lot of us have been saying this season since he came on against Spurs and did really well. It's like, well, if he's available, we've got to play him, which I don't think any of us ever predicted that we'd be saying about Fabian Delph. But I think if he is available, he starts in the three for me. Give him an hour, then bring Gomez on, see what happens.
Yeah.
The thing with Palace is they're a very fast attacking team. They've got a lot of attacking talent. They've got that Gallagher kid in the middle as well.
Yeah.
He looks like he's going to be some player. He's one of Chelsea's, isn't he? So he looks like he's going to be some player, and he's someone who, if not needs man marking, someone needs to keep an eye on him in and around the box, because he's that type of player who just pops up from midfield and can finish. So he could be a big issue. And if you've got, you know, if you've got the Corey bombing up the pitch and then they break quickly, suddenly we can be outnumbered. I think if Benitez is a pragmatic manager, he will look at the midfield, see that his play is better with the three, with the personnel he's got. Next season, he can do what he likes when he signs his own players to play his formation. But as a manager, you've got to, you know, use the cards you've been dealt. He's not been dealt a particularly good pack. It's not the worst, but make the best out of it. And I think playing the 4-2-3-1, it doesn't get the best out of this group.
4-2-3-1, Les. Has there ever been a club that was more attached to 4-2-3-1 than us?
Well, I want to be my formation that I play.
I'm not saying there's nothing inherently wrong with a 4-2-3-1. You just have to have the personnel to play, like any formation, right? Yeah. But like, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't Marco Silva come in as a 4-3-3 guy and then just somehow never played it?
He did. He was 4-3-3 all the way and then played 4-2-3-1. It's like this contractual obligation when you sign for him. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's another one of those games, Palace away, isn't it? It's a bit of a toin cost.
There we go. I was wondering, we're close to the end of this episode, and I had no idea what we were going to name it. Now I know we're going to name it toin cost. So it is a coin toss. It is a bit of a coin toss, though.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's a Sunday game as well. Is it 2 o'clock on Sunday?
Is it a Sunday game? Oh, man.
Yeah. Oh, so it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, which is just the worst kickoff time.
2 o'clock, okay.
It's half four. Half four on Sunday.
I for some reason thought it was Saturday. I'm glad it's not. We need the extra. It's always good to have that extra day after a Monday game. Yeah. Oh yeah. Nice 10:30. That's a nice brunch game for me on Sunday. I can certainly handle that, Les.
That sounds ideal.
All right, Les, this has been great football chat. I want to end. We're right at about the hour, and I told you I'd try to stick as close to this end time for you as possible, because I know you've got a life to go live and all of that. But really quickly, I am, just so you know, I am working on, I'm finalizing my year-end albums list. I have to do this every year, I have to do it for work, for the station, the radio station that I do a Saturday night show for. All the hosts submit their best of lists every year to the station, and they do a big like series of they put them all on the website and stuff like that. So though admittedly I'm the kind of nerdy kid that was doing my own year-end list before anyone was even asking for them, because I just like I love list making as a sport, and I love ranking things. It's just the best, especially when you rank art, which is silly to rank art, and yet people do it all the time. So this Saturday night, shameless plug for my show Turn of the Century, which I will be, of course, uploading onto Mixcloud. If you ever want to go back and listen to these episodes, you just need like an hour. Let's can attest to this. I put some pretty good music on there every Saturday night.
Mate, I love it. It's essential listening.
There you go. And Les is not being paid for shilling for me right now, but I'm doing a special episode. This is my last episode of 2021 before our big Christmas break. The whole station changes over to holiday music. I don't know if that's a thing over there, but they certainly hammered it into the ground here.
Yeah, full bump over here.
Yeah, I'm doing a special episode on my favorite albums of 2021. So I'm playing like, I think I just fit in the hour. I took my 12 favorite albums and picked a song from each. I'm not going to go through all 12, but I did want to highlight, and I don't know that I've totally ranked them yet. I'm still kind of sorting that out right now.
This isn't the laminated version.
Yeah, until I've laminated it, it's not final. And look, this is all very scientific. There's a very strategic process that goes into this. I imagine I'm much like, you know, Marco Silva was in overthinking everything to the point of ruining it. But I love this. So I'm gonna give you my top five albums of the year, because I think I got my top five-ish pretty set. Les, again, these are not in any order at this point, so whatever. But I'm just gonna say this group of five. One is an album by this band that I had not heard of until somewhat recently. And this is one of my favorite things about 2021 or about any new music year, is that sometimes you just find a band that comes out of nowhere and just blows you away with an album. This band called Magdalena Bay. And I will send these all to you because, Les, I think you're going to like all of these albums, or at least four of the five of these albums for sure. Magdalena Bay, the album is called Mercurial World. And it is a mixture of sounds that everything from like electronica, synth, and, you know, new wave and video game sounds. I don't even know how to really describe it. And I'm a big fan of bands who you can't really fully describe the genre because it's a mix of all these things. But
yeah,
I will tell you, the feeling I got listening to it was very similar to the feeling that I got listening the first heard in 83. If anyone remembers, I guess it was, oh gosh, was it 2013? I think, you know, like when Midnight City came out and all of that. Hurry Up, We're Dreaming came out. It was 2011. And I remember hearing that and thinking, I've never heard anything that made me, that sounded quite like this before and made me feel this way before. That is how Mercurial World by Magdalena Bay sounds. And it is just absolutely addictive, like pop sugary amazingness, yet it doesn't feel cheap and it doesn't feel shallow. It's like pure joy just listening to this album. So highly recommend that. Next one is, and this is probably my all names album of the year, Dream Weapon by Genghis Tron. Now that is so many talking points there. Genghis Tron is the name of the band. Dream Weapon is the name of the album. And absolutely the most beautiful album cover of the year for me. And Dream Weapon is, I think, a reference to an album by Spaceman 3, who ended up, one half of them ended up going on to form Spiritualized, for those of you of the English persuasion who are familiar with them. Genghis Tron is like a synth metal album, and it's not really that hard rocking of an album, but yet it's got kind of, you know, fast drums and some hard guitars, but it also mixes in synth with it too. And it's actually just kind of a beautiful, soaring listen. Highly recommend that. Next is Private Sunshine by Lou Hayter, H-A-Y-T-R. She is English or Australian. I can't remember if she's English or Australian. I need to do some more research, clearly. But she was, I believe, the lead singer of a band called New Young Pony Club that was big.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Awesome.
Yeah. Just totally, if you love beats, you love stuff you can dance to, this album, Private Sunshine, feels like an ode to like mid to late 80s, electro pop from, you know, like American and English, like, you know, electro pop. It sounds like something that I could play songs off of. And if I told you it was from 1988, you would totally believe me. My top two, or the final two, A Way Forward by Nation of Language. Nation of Language's debut album last year, Introduction Presence, was my number one album of 2020. They followed it up with their sophomore LP this year, A Way Forward. It is an incredible album that genuinely sounds, their sound can best be described as early to mid 80s new wave alternative. Like they sound like I could play them along with Echo and the Bunnymen and New Order. And if I played that album for you, you would think that it had been made in 1982 and you would not even phase you at all.
Seamlessly hit the Vice City soundtrack.
Oh yeah. There you go. Perfect. It absolutely does that. And then my final one that I recommend this year, Infinite Granite by Def Heaven. Def Heaven are, they've been kind of a metal band, but this album is a total shoegaze album. So if you're a Slow Dive or a My Bloody Valentine or a early Verve fan, man, you will love this album. It's incredible. It's just, it rocks hard, but yet it is not, it's so hard to rock that if you're kind of squeamish about metal sounds that it's gonna make you crazy. It rocks hard enough. The songs have great hooks, very, very great pop sensibilities to them in terms of just songs that will stick in your head for a long time. So those are just five albums from this year that, and again, I think I'll put a little playlist together out and share it on the Blue Room Twitter for later on. Les, I asked if you would bring, you know, two or three albums from this year that you absolutely love. You're one of my music leaders. You are one of the people whose opinion I value most. So what have you got for me?
I've got a different five.
Hopefully, yeah.
Well, I mean, quite predictably, I've got two Wirral albums and I've got a Liverpool one as well. First one, okay. Coral Island. It was just classically The Coral. It's such a good album. First time I listened to it, I was slightly underwhelmed because there was nothing that really jumped out. You know, like some of the bigger hits that they play live. They're such a good live band as well.
The Coral are a Liverpool band, yeah?
They're from Hoylake. From the Oblong Man.
Okay.
So, but yeah, when they do a live set, they definitely play to the crowd. So they're not one of these bands who go, right, we're going to do six off our new album, which is out next week, and everyone goes to bar for a drink. They will do all the songs that people want. But this album, when I first heard it, nothing really jumped out like that. But then a couple of listens in, it is just a wonderful sort of seaside town album.
Nothing like the album that takes repeated listens and then rewards you more over time. You know,
it's good, isn't it? Yeah. Especially when you've got high hopes for it and you think, oh, it wasn't what I expected. And then actually, yeah, it was more than that. Next one, She Drew the Gun, Behave Myself.
So, She Drew the Gun, okay.
Yeah, I think she's from Birkenhead.
I love how local you are, by the way. All right, got it. Tell me what She Drew the Gun sounds like. Oh, wait, no, She Drew the Gun was on one of our early turn playlists back in the day, I believe.
Yes. Yeah, I think Resistor was. So it's, I can't really describe. So there's some like electro sounds in there. It's quite politically motivated. Mm-hmm. She is from Wirral as well, Louisa Roach.
Is the album called, is it Next on the List? Or
Behave Myself is the new album from this year.
Oh, is the name. Okay, for some reason, I'm only finding her singles. Yeah, I'm only finding her singles, but yeah, I will check that out.
Yeah, next one's Arm & Hammer.
Yeah, I've been hearing about that.
Yeah, which is like, I've only been listening to it the last week, but it's really good sort of jazz hip-hop stuff. Yeah, that's ace. Saint Etienne, I've been trying to tell you. Have you listened to much Saint Etienne?
I've gotten into Saint Etienne kind of late in life.
Yeah.
I recently got into because I played them on the show. It was a couple months ago, I think. But I put their 1991 album Fox Bass Alpha.
Amazing.
Is just an incredible album. I played a song called Spring from that album, which is incredible.
Yeah.
They have a new, I forgot that they had a new album out this year.
If you're hoping for anything like You're in a Bad Way, anything poppy like that, it's not that, it's the other way. You've gone really chilled and quite electronic. It's really good though. I think they've done one of the best cover versions ever, which is quite low key, but Only Love Can Break Your Heart. Cover version by them. And the last one's Clinic, Fantasy Island.
Oh, Clinic. Now, there's another Merseyside band that I've played on the show several times. Yeah. They've always had a very distinct sound. Like, you know when you're hearing Clinic. For
yeah,
sure.
It's quite psychedelic and quite electro, but it's definitely, yeah, it's very Clinic. So, yeah, they've got a new album out as well this year. So that's my five.
Does Clinic still do the bit where, I mean, they wear the surgical scrubs and the masks on stage and everything?
I hope so, because remember when they first started, that was their thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, and now it seems ahead of its time, doesn't it?
They were just being, like, safe and like, hygienic.
They were COVID ready before there was COVID, yeah.
No, that's my five, and when I put the list together before, I didn't realize I'd actually done three from round our way.
Yeah, no, that's all right.
I'm very parochial, aren't I, if nothing else?
Les, you're a man. You're a man of your city. I love it. I love it. Well, good. See, look, that's and I think I added all of them. And if I can't find one, I'll add it later. I'll put out a little mini Kickabout 2021 playlist and post it to the Blue Room account. Les, thanks for spending a little extra time. I know we went a little bit over, but no, man, I had you on to talk about me. I had you on. I had to ask about music, buddy.
Yeah, oh no, fully into it, man. Yeah, send us those albums as well. I'll take a listen. I need some new stuff.
100%. Well, guys, that is it for this week here on The Kickabout. We have got a lot, obviously, just the usual slew of shows coming up this week, the weekly, subs weekly. I think some of these are either coming out today. We're recording on Wednesday. Kickabout will be out. I think you'll probably be listening to this by Thursday. And then, of course, you will have post-match coming up on, now we found out, Sunday. I'm glad I have an extra day to just enjoy the Arsenal victory. But for Les Roberts, I am Rob Vera. We will see you guys next time for more Kickabouts. Take care.
Searching for just the right job? Whether you're looking for full-time, part-time, or seasonal work, you can get started today. Amazon Jobs offer the whole package with great pay and flexible shifts that allow you to choose when and how much you work. Find a warehouse close to home and discover the role that works for you. To get your application started for an hourly job, go to amazon.com/apply. That's amazon.com/apply. Amazon is proud to be an equal opportunity employer.
Sports Social Podcast Network.